Welcome to episode 41 of The Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and each week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. This week's guest is Tim Sassine, Business Development Manager at Ballard Power. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. Ballard Power's vision is to deliver fuel cell power for a sustainable planet by being the leading global provider of innovative clean energy solutions and offering superior performance at a reduced operating cost. By relentlessly developing and improving their technology, they will make a real difference by empowering zero-emission fuel cell vehicles that will positively change the lives of the next generation. And if you want an unprecedented opportunity to connect with key stakeholders and explore what's next in the utility sector, join me at GridConnect in Washington, D.C., December 10th through 12th. I'll be recording an episode of The Climate Champions live the morning of the 10th, followed by world-class experts exploring diverse perspectives and uncovering market innovations poised to redraw the electric utility landscape. Secure your spot at GridConnect by registering now at GridConnect.com. With an X, not a C, .com. Tim has dedicated his career to bringing clean tech energy solutions in hydrogen, electric vehicles, microgrids, and wind power from concept to production. Tim's work has brought reliability to residential wind turbines, public acceptance to fuel cell vehicles, and innovation to utility-scale wind turbines. World firsts have rewarded his efforts, such as the highest mileage fuel cell vehicle deployment to date, the best-selling wind turbine in the world, and the first true variable speed induction generator wind turbine. Tim energizes teams of highly skilled innovators to achieve exceptional results in reliability, cost-effectiveness, serviceability, and consumer appeal. For the last few years, Tim and I have been getting together to debate microgrids, hydrogen, fuel cells, the role of utilities, and whether to meet at 7:30 a.m. or 8 a.m. It's been a great friendship, and I've learned a tremendous amount. Welcome to Climate Champions. I am here with Tim Sassine, Business Development Manager at Ballard Power. Tim, welcome to Climate Champions.
Hi, Lee. Great to be here. I've been looking forward to this.
I know. I've been trying to get you for a long time.
Thank you. I feel studied up and ready.
Now the bar is really high, okay? That's a warning. With regards to climate change, what was your motivating moment that made you want to engage and do something about it?
I've been concerned about pollution in general since my later days of high school. I actually remember voting Republican. I was in the Bob Dole camp. I specifically remember the posters in my dorm room, but having that feeling that our industrial age was having too high of an external impact. And that continued throughout my college career. I studied electrical engineering and got a job in making compact discs. Some of your older listeners will remember those. Still being concerned about the environment, but not knowing how to really get involved. And then I heard an interview on a radio show on public radio from a gentleman named Bill Mollison, a key figure in the permaculture movement. And he changed my perspective completely. Up until that point, I was gaining the attitude and the perspective that pollution, climate change, man-made impacts from our industrial way of living was causing irreparable damage to the world we live in, and that the two were simply incompatible. In the more progressive circles, that was the perspective. Mankind and modern civilization was parasitic to the natural systems, which is very disappointing. And the perspective that was presented was either you're part of the problem or you're part of the solution. So you either give up or bail out. Bill Mollison's perspective, and permaculture in general, is the integration of technology into natural processes and identifying natural processes that naturally work towards each other, where one system's waste becomes the fuel or the food for another system. This blew my mind. This meant that it was possible that we could grow an evolved and beneficial society with high technological capabilities, meaning communication, transportation, the things that we enjoy, in harmony with the earth and continue to grow plants and species and have a biodiverse world. This was incredible to me. And after I heard that radio show, I want to call it a podcast, it was a radio show, I had decided that it was time to change. And I opened myself up. I announced really to the creator that I'm available for this work. Show me where to go. And in no time at all, I had found Southwest Wind Power, a little startup company in Flagstaff, Arizona, making small wind turbine generators, really for sailboats and remote cabins, and they needed an electrical engineer. This was a genius guy that had gone to college, decided it wasn't for him, went off to build his own little factory making wind turbines out of car alternators and learning about aerodynamics and electromagnetics, and really a Da Vinci kind of character. David Calley is the gentleman's name. I still look up to him. He wanted some electrical engineering expertise. I wanted to get involved in creating the solutions. I took a pay cut of about 30%, packed up and moved off to Arizona, and I haven't looked back since. It was the best move I ever made.
So it sounds like right away it was very personal to you, but if you were to frame it from a personal perspective now, what drives you?
Now it's pretty clear. My son's 4.5. His name's Ocean, and he is going to see what this society looks like in 20 years when he is staking out his claim in the world. It's pretty clear it's going to be very different. We're not going to go from our present state to a better state, even in the best of scenarios. We're going to go through some challenging times. I can't imagine spending my time now doing anything else that could possibly be of benefit to him other than working on making this a livable planet. It's immensely personal. I also have my own selfish reasons in that I like to go outside. I like to hike. I like to go into the wilderness and see, you know, beautiful, massive forests and not see huge stands of beetle kill or deal with forest fires or worry about the purity of the water around me. That's all very tangible and relevant, I think, particularly to the people who live in the Western United States. We tend to get out into those environments often. Not that others don't, but we certainly put a huge value and focus on it. But from Ocean's perspective, I can't imagine engaging in anything else at this time and feeling at all that I was using my time wisely.
When you talk about this, there's a confidence that you know why you're doing it and what you're doing and that it matters so much. When you meet people who don't understand what you're talking about, either they don't believe that climate is changing in any significant way, or they believe that it's natural and humans have nothing to do with it, how do you go about explaining to them that it is due to human behavior and that it is very dangerous?
We had insights back in Southwest Wind Power Day that to win this argument, we had to win in areas that were important to the people that we were talking to. When I talk to conservatives, Republicans, people that are very much focused on the economy and on personal comfort, I focus on those areas that are conducive to that. So domestic energy resources was something that we recognized in wind power would be a very valuable argument, that this is a way to use domestic U.S. energy resources for substitution of external resources that come at a very high cost, not only in dollars, but also in national treasure, in war. We know that if we can produce those things domestically, that we can avoid a lot of those externalities. I focus on those sorts of arguments. Also on the stimulation to the economy, the stimulation to entrepreneurship, new businesses, businesses that have grown here in the United States, particularly where innovation is so prevalent in our economy. We can easily point to Tesla and other success stories that have shown that new energy approaches can be profitable. If they dispute that man-made climate change is real, at this point, I still have to go along with those that say that it's a matter of philosophy and religion at this point. It's hard to say that you could draw a rational argument that would change the mind of somebody convinced that climate change is either not real or is not anthropocentric. I think if that person exists, that person has not been in touch with technology and probably isn't interested in technology anyways. I think the most effective path to really convincing people that do not believe that climate change exists and is from man-made causes is really to keep the perspective broad. And I have this conversation with people that are close to me too. It's hard to get excited about climate change investments. It's hard to think about paying higher taxes or paying more money towards something that doesn't really directly impact you. If you live here in San Diego, you're impacted by climate change in marginal ways. You might have forest fire that's nearby that you didn't have forest fires that often. You have air quality impacts. Those don't happen that often. It's easy to forget about them once they're gone, unless your house or neighborhood was directly impacted. And we see erosion events on the cliff sides. We see the cliffs of Encinitas disappearing at a more rapid rate. Amtrak is going to have to be rerouted from where it's at to tunneled underneath La Jolla because the sea is changing, because weather events are changing, because there's more energy in our climate. You have to point to those events, and you have to keep reminding people that these things are happening, and they're happening around the world, that real people are being displaced, real people are being put into difficult circumstances, and those people, in many cases, really aren't that different from us. It's happening here in the United States with all the hurricane activity as well. That has to be kept forefront. People have to be reminded of that, because when you live in a comfortable place like San Diego, it's easy to forget about all of that and say that that's somewhere future down the road until the blackouts start happening regularly, until the fires start happening regularly, until fresh water becomes scarce and expensive, until living a comfortable lifestyle becomes something that only people that are very privileged can do, and everybody else has to share resources and degraded states of health and degraded lifestyles that are far too expensive to come back on. The biggest challenge we have, I think, with climate change right now is timing, the pace. We have a window in California, even with all of our immense financial resources, that we can spend money to develop technology that benefits everyone until we have to spend money to take care of all the impacts of climate change. Once we have to spend far more money because of forest fires, because of scarce fresh water, when adaptation overwhelms innovation, we have a very difficult path at that point. That's the point that we have to react to. It's not the point at which we hit these temperature targets for the climate. It's the point where we can no longer afford to invest in avoiding them.
When we get to a point when adaptation is more expensive than innovation, that point will still carry with it an urgency to everyone that we have to innovate. So we will collect the money. It might be with increased taxes. I don't know how he will do it, but we will be focusing on innovation as well as adaptation, or otherwise there's no future.
I certainly hope that that's true. We still are dealing with finite resources. Even now in San Diego, it's difficult to live what would have been considered a middle-class lifestyle in the 70s in a middle-class neighborhood. In California, we have the luxury of having a tremendous amount of wealth, most of which was generated these days by information technology. So we know that the most wealthy companies in the world, in fact, deal with information. That money has gone largely into Silicon Valley and into the LA basin and is starting to repollinate in some reinvestment into energy companies. And that's fantastic. Other states don't have those luxuries. We're quite unique in that respect. We're one of the few extremely wealthy states. When you start looking to the interior of the United States, their budgets for investing into new and novel technologies get very thin, if they're around at all. And some of the hesitation to even acknowledge climate change is also the realization that they can't afford to invest in things that they can't be 100% certain about. So I hope you're right. I hope that the problems, we find ways to fund them because we simply have to. Again, I would say there's the danger that there are some who will be able to and there are some that are not.
No disagreement from me with anything that you said. I do think the sooner we get on this, the lower the peak of pain we're going to feel and the less we're going to contribute along the way. So I say let's go, go, go as soon as we can. I just think that there is an ecosystem effect that when things get so bad and you're fighting for your survival, innovation is going to be one of the tools to fight for that survival. Can you talk about Ballard Power and what you do there?
Ballard Power Systems is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. Very happy about that. Jeffrey Ballard started it 40 years ago, back when I was building model rockets and listening to Kiss. He was finding ways to replace the internal combustion engine. That was his original motivation. He had started off in lithium-ion batteries, but quickly pivoted to fuel cells when he saw the potential that could be there for transportation. And the first thing he went to was a bus. And in 1993, he rolled out a fuel cell-powered bus up at the Canadian Expo in Vancouver. And since then, there's been a steady progression of buses. I joined up with Ballard in 2000, right when they were starting to build buses for a European project. We were deploying buses in 7 different countries, 10 different cities. I worked on developing the control system for that drivetrain for Daimler, and then went over to Europe and managed the deployment of that from the bus manufacturing facility in Mannheim, Germany. And that was incredibly inspiring for me personally, but also emboldening for not only Ballard, but other companies to look and take fuel cells quite seriously. So Ballard since then has evolved that platform. That was a pure fuel cell platform. We've now incorporated in batteries to hybridize the platform for maximum efficiency, maximum energy recovery. And we're starting to move out into other platforms, into trucks and port vehicles and cargo handling and marine applications and rail. We have significant operations over in Europe. We've got an office in Hobro, Denmark, and they are doing several different marine projects in addition to fuel cell buses. There's a big fuel cell bus initiative there called Jive that's putting out 300 buses to drive down the cost. We have 2 joint ventures in China where we're selling some of the core technology but keeping some of the technology back at home to protect our IP, but also allowing us to ramp up production. The primary financial barrier for fuel cells right now are related to scale and volume, really getting in the kind of automation that batteries have enjoyed over the past decade to really drive down costs in that sector. Those opportunities are wide open in fuel cells. We really have a lot of cost out that we have in front of us, even as we've taken out bus costs essentially down to half of what they were just 8 or 9 years ago. So Ballard now is moving forward internationally and globally, focused primarily on heavy duty and with a lot of passionate people. It's amazing how many people I know there that have 10, 15, 20 years experience at the same company. Interesting in any industry, and particularly in this one, there's a vision there that's compelling, that keeps people there, that keeps them dedicated. No matter what the ups and downs of the market may be, the technology has a pretty clear path. And with people that committed, the progress has been slow, steady, and definite. And we now are about to reach the fruition of what Jeffrey Ballard had started almost half a century ago.
Can you tell me about some of your background before your time at Ballard?
Yeah, my background before Ballard started in wind. Wind was my first love. Small wind. I had gotten turned on to hydrogen from a class that was put on by the American Hydrogen Association in Phoenix, Arizona. People there were converting cars to run on hydrogen, and hydrogen you could get from wind and solar. This was tremendous to me. I could see that wind was progressing well, but this problem of energy carriers and energy sources really had to be addressed. Hydrogen blew my mind, and Ballard was the key in that. When we had gotten through the fuel cell bus program in Europe, and we had gotten through a generation, I led the engineering team for our 6th generation of fuel cell module. The focus at Ballard had shifted. Some of the euphoria of the automotive applications was starting to die down. The stock market was getting less impressed. And there wasn't the regulatory environment that we have now that really pushes zero emission vehicles. So I decided that the solutions that we needed were not technological in nature. The biggest problems to be solved were not technological in nature. They were actually more of a business problem and of a energy source problem. I left Ballard in 2008 when Obama took office to come back to the United States, also a very inspirational event for me. I worked at a company called Clipper Wind Power, which was started by Jim Dielson, who had started Zond, and Zond eventually became GE Wind Turbines. He was one of the early pioneers of wind technology in the United States. Clipper was an interesting example in how to build up a company fast, but not necessarily in the most sound way. After having one prototype up for 6 months, they then started production on these 2.5 megawatt wind turbines.
That's very quick.
It's very quick. It's very quick. And a 2.5 megawatt wind turbine is a serious endeavor. That's like an automotive factory. And yes, you start to bake in problems that you didn't have time to find out in the meantime. While I was working at Clipper Wind Power, there was another startup that was beginning in the same area, just in Santa Barbara, kind of a nascent little hub of technological innovation called Continental Wind Power. And we were setting out to build a 400 kilowatt wind turbine at that time, which would fit well in California's incentive program. The self-generation incentive program had really good funding for generators that were under megawatt at the time. As we got our brand new wind turbine design ready, as we had our prototype on the floor, I was as surprised as our investors to find out there was no money in the bank to complete the execution of this. And this started to stitch together the story that what is really needed in renewable energy are sound business and financial approaches. The technological innovation is there. The spirit that grew the internet wasn't necessarily going to be the same of the same flavor as what would grow the energy industry. One of my colleagues from Clipper Wind Power went off to Boulder, Colorado in another startup along my startup adventures. And that company, Boulder Wind Power, was doing a 3 megawatt direct drive generator, very novel technology. This generator was based not on winding copper wires around a stator, but on making giant printed circuit boards in a huge direct drive wind turbine. Very well funded for a startup. They had funding from several different prominent VC firms and had great technology from the standpoint of making something very difficult a reality. However, what they didn't have was a value proposition. They didn't have something that would actually make the turbine cheaper. It made it different and interesting, but ultimately the cost did not turn out to be cheaper, which was difficult.
So you really need the entire package. You need the technology, you need the money, you need the vision. You need to be in the right place at the right time.
Right. You need an MBA. And that's why I came back to UCSD, to San Diego, with my wife to live and grow our family here. And UCSD has an excellent program at the Rady School of Business Management for entrepreneurs, specifically focused on entrepreneurship. And in technology, when we're talking about innovation, new companies, new technologies coming online, having some skills around entrepreneurship and financial discipline and understanding how a business can stay afloat to make cash flows continue to flow is important. And that's the kind of perspective that's needed when bringing a new technology to a customer, to an environment, to try to convince somebody who may not be fully convinced of the technical necessity, or let's say the environmental necessity of your technology. You need to convince them through financial means. So you need to be able to speak that language.
When you were going through your background, it sounded like a lot of it were setbacks. Are there others you want to talk about, or did you just summarize them pretty well?
I think I summarized them, but I don't really see them as setbacks. I mean, when you play in the startup world, you got to be ready to bounce around. If you expect to jump into a startup and hit your IPO from that very same company that you just joined, you're going to get disappointed. I will lay odds, and my odds are about as good as the lottery in the reverse direction that I'm going to be right. You're not going to do it right the first time. And any entrepreneur you talk to will tell you that same thing. What really makes a difference in starting out new ventures, new technologies, is your recovery. How do you pick up after what you didn't work? Can you continue? Can you build on it? And I think you have to go through some setbacks. You have to go through some trials that don't work out in order to know how to build a better mousetrap the next time. So I wouldn't consider those so much setbacks as part of a career choice. As I say, when you decide to get into startups, you better be ready for some changes along the way. It's totally fine. And it actually has informed the way that I approach business and industry incredibly. You have to be able to speak at the multinational level, and you have to be able to speak at the garage level, and you have to be able to speak to the people that are actually using the technology. If you don't get experience across that spectrum, you're going to have trouble at some point, and you're going to have to rely on somebody else, or you're going to stumble.
If you're not failing, sometimes you're not taking enough risk.
Exactly. That's totally true.
How about successes? What are your biggest successes that you're most proud of?
The fuel cell bus program in Europe was undoubtedly one of the biggest successes. The operators there, the people who use those buses, just fell in love with them. This was technology that not only was taking care of a problem, it was technology that people were falling in love with. And this is what makes it happen. I used to say the buses run on love. That's what you need. You need to engender that. It was incredibly inspiring, fantastically inspiring. I think that probably is one of the greatest achievements that I've been a part of. That and really early on launching out the Air 403. That was our first small wind turbine at Southwest Wind Power. And we had re-engineered the entire wind turbine when I came on and released it in 1999. An auspicious year for energy.
Uh-huh.
There was a lot of concern that maybe the lights wouldn't come on January 1st in 2000. And I have to be honest, we benefited from that.
I was in IT then, so I was up late nights making sure that the lights came on.
Yep. And come to find out, they pretty much stayed on. Well, fortunately, the people that were concerned that you weren't going to do your job had bought our wind turbines, and those wind turbines lasted. Our warranty rates went from 50% down to 0.5%. We went from selling 200 units a month to 1,400 units a month, and with maintaining a high level of quality and a high dedication to the end customer. One of the best projects I worked on was in the Navajo Nation. There was a social justice lawyer that had set up a RV there to help out the Diné people or the Navajo people as Peabody Coal was working to disrupt the relationship between the Navajo and the Hopi, to blur the boundary lines between those two nations, and in fact, inventing boundary lines between those nations. So this lawyer had set up there to give them a voice, and she needed power. And I was able to go there to bring her one of our wind turbines and to bring her a solar panel and some batteries and hook it all up and to give her the ability to give a voice to people that really had no other voice and were being seriously impacted really by a climate issue, by extraction of this resource that was outdated, dirty, and in fact, socially corrupting. And that was inspiring. It was inspiring to see that come together to really come to the benefit of people who really needed it.
Can you talk about your vision for the future? How do you see the world 10, 20, 30 years from now? And talk a little bit about where you see hydrogen.
Certainly, we can look towards societies that are already very dense. We look at Europe and we see people living in very close proximity there and in some harmonious ways. So, I mean, I would look to see parallels there. I think micromobility is fantastic. And I think we're going to see a proliferation of that and an orientation of our streetscapes around that as well. We're going to see places where you can ride whatever scooters turn into be 20 years from now, lower speed, single person devices to get you easily around that are very low energy impact. We'll see cities redesign around that. We'll see probably areas that we won't be able to go to for a very long time because of adaptation concerns. There, as I say, prices will be paid along this way. We'll lose access to some of those things, some things that are dear to us, but I think that'll reinforce our resolve to make the places where we live even better and even more coexistent. It won't look the same here as it does in Europe. We still will have people that live very remotely. We'll have ways of moving things around that will be very amenable to that. And I think in the United States, hydrogen will play a very strong role with that. Hydrogen works well anytime you have high energy density that you have to deal with. And that could be high energy density from having a lot of vehicles in one spot, such as at a bus depot in an urban center. Or it could be in having an energy resource that's very remote, such as a remote solar or wind installation, that you need to move that energy around in a flexible way where you don't want to set up new high tension lines and you don't want to set up permanent infrastructure where you want different vectors for that. The United States is going to want that. We have a lot of cities that have a great distance between themselves and other cities. Those aren't going away. That'll flavor the way that sustainable society in the United States will look. And we'll see hydrogen playing roles in longer transportation vectors, certainly in marine. We know that these freighters that run around on bunker fuel, they're burning some of the worst fuel that's available, some of the dirtiest fuel that's available. Hydrogen provides a means to pack in enough of that fuel to make those ships move. We also see innovations in wind coming back to freight, which is pretty cool. We'll see hydrogen in rail, no question. We've already started several projects in rail using hydrogen. That gives us another vector that needs a lot of energy over a long distance. And we'll see hydrogen eventually in aircraft. The first fuel cell powered aircraft has been tested. It's in testing right now. There's already battery-powered aircraft in commercial operation in Vancouver doing tourist duty. So we're going to see that sort of innovation as well. And I think we're going to see a lot of changes in not only commerce, but also in food and in how we grow and how we consume food and what we consider to be acceptable fuel, food, fuel for humans. We're going to see less meat, more plant-based, more innovative plant materials.
We're already seeing a lot of that.
Yeah, I heard that some of the fast food restaurants are starting to carry some good veggie burger options. I'm excited about that. So I think we're going to have a lot of pain between here and there. There's going to be things that we lose necessarily that are going to hurt. But we're going to get on the other side of that. And what comes out on the other side, I believe, what I see is a leaner society that has less dependence on spending time to dedicate to our technology, spending time in our car, spending time making things work that should work otherwise. That sort of technology will become transparent, having to pull out our phone and look at our phone all the time, where our time will increasingly be spent is in social situations. And I think that future generations are going to see the folly of us focusing on accumulating material goods and on trying to consume more to improve happiness. And they're going to see the benefits of increasing quality of life through interaction with other humans. And I think, you know, some of the internet boom and some of our advances in learning that can be shared across an entire civilization are going to bring that to fruition. The access to the internet makes everybody smarter if you choose to be smarter. And those that don't choose to be smarter, I think, are going to show themselves very quickly. If nothing else, these accelerating accelerations, as Thomas Friedman says, will very quickly cause social evolution to happen. And we have to say that we're going to survive through this. And that means that the people that don't have long-term sustaining ideals on how we do things won't be around for very long to keep propagating those ideals. I've got a lot of faith in how we've evolved and how our generation behaves today relative to prior generations. I don't want to put it on future generations, but I do want to take a little bit of pride in how the baby boomers and how the Gen Xers have progressed beyond what was done at the beginning of the last century and the things that we've learned. We can't keep trying to throw away everybody who doesn't have the most modern, up-to-date, evolved perspective because they had problems sometime in their past. Everybody has to grow, everybody has to evolve, and everybody has to be patient with each other. And the people that are going to be around to guide our society are going to be the ones that understand that.
Do you have any questions for me?
I would love to know how you see the utility model evolving over the next 20 years. And I ask that because utilities play such a central role in how energy gets around in our society. And by nature, they're a regulated entity because of poles and wires. And for me, hydrogen provides so many other benefits of being a flexible fuel, a market competing fuel, and that utilities are stuck in this century plus old model of being a regulated and yet for-profit business. That doesn't seem sustainable.
I don't think one size fits all. There are a number of potential paths that it can take, and I think it will be different for each utility based on decisions that they make, that their state makes, that their country makes, that they happen to be in. We're already seeing different paths for European utilities than utilities in the United States. I can certainly see utilities in the United States not doing very much about the changes that are happening and finding themselves with very high rates and finding that their customers find other solutions and that their states start backing other solutions because they're just less expensive and cleaner. Other utilities might be able to successfully make investments in a smarter grid in a way to make renewable energy less expensive and be able to be shared by people easily and find that cost to be reasonable and innovate to make it reasonable. And so maybe they'll still be around. It also depends on the amount of renewable energy that that their customers have access to. If they don't have access to a lot, the utility becomes more important. Those utilities will probably fare better. Also, if we get to the point where climate adaptation is big and we need innovation, but we also need speed and everybody recognize it, the utilities might be called upon to make more investments than ever and potentially make more money than ever. So that could work in their favor if they're called upon for that expertise to build infrastructure quickly and reliably. So there's a lot of ways it could go.
So if you could change one thing in the energy strategy of the United States, just one thing that would be impactful, what would it be?
This is going to sound like a cop-out, but I think we can go a lot faster, and I would like government to insist upon that fact, to go as fast as we possibly can, because again, the longer we wait, the worse it's going to be at peak for us. And so anything we can do now, we should be doing it, and there's a lot more we can be doing now. Do you have anything else you want to say?
Yes, I do. There's one thing that I want to point to in California, and that's everybody needs to really get a deeper understanding of what this 2045 carbon neutrality goal means. It's big. It's not a small issue. This is transforming all of California's energy systems into a carbon-free energy system. And one little stat that I'd like to point out is that in 2015, that's the most recent data I have from the Air Resources Board or the Energy Commission, that in 2015, we used 20 billion gallons of diesel and gasoline. About three quarters of that was gasoline. It was about $19 billion all told, but you get it out energy equivalent. It's called 20 billion gallons of gasoline. In every gallon of gasoline, you've got something like 36 kilowatt hours of what gets to the road, assuming that all that diesel and gasoline is going to the road. What gets to the road, probably less than a third of that, let's call it 10 kilowatt hours. So now you've got 200 billion kilowatt hours, which is the same as 200,000 gigawatt hours. That is precisely what has been served on the California grid, give or take 10 or 20% for the last 20 years. What that means is that if we choose to electrify all of transportation strictly by doing grid charging, at least from an energy perspective, we're going to have to double that. So that means that there is a lot of new generation that's going to have to come online, all of which has to be carbon free. So if we're halfway there now, which we're not quite, but let's call it that, if we're going to have to double that for the sake of transportation, that means we're going to have to build what we have now three times over again in renewable generation. That means putting solar and wind farms in places that we haven't put them yet. And if we do that all through the grid, that's putting up a lot of high voltage lines where we didn't necessarily want to put them. And also means that we have a heck of a lot of storage that we're going to have to deal with in order to deal with the sun going up and going down and the wind going up and going down. This is where hydrogen can really play a role. People talk about hydrogen being produced from curtailed renewables. I say the better way to do it is to put the new renewables that we know we're going to need in places where they're most suited and difficult to reach by the grid and make fuel and use that fuel for transportation. And also, with the advances in floating wind turbines and offshore wind technology, use that for fuel production as well. And we'll continue to use the grid for light-duty transportation, for battery electric vehicles, certainly where they make sense. But hydrogen production is a necessary part of that carbon-neutral evolution of the California grid. And really, that's analogous to the rest of the country and the rest of the world. We need all of these arrows in our quiver to get through this with the kind of speed that we're talking about. We can't go to the exclusion of a technology that we know can work, and we have to be able to leverage the infrastructure that we already have in place. That's the kind of speed to get to what you're talking about, Lee, to do this as quickly as possible because we know we have to do it. Let's make sure that when we talk about an energy strategy for carbon neutrality, that we include every technology that makes it possible and that we map that out and we just don't say, well, you know, we'll get so far and then innovation will solve it and we can just wait on new solutions to come down the road. Let's be prescriptive about this. Let's be wide-eyed and let's have a strategy and let's be ready to adapt and pivot as the challenges come up. But let's have a direction and a roadmap put forward.
Given the NIMBY, not in my backyard concerns, I don't see us doubling the size of the electric grid. And given the cost concerns, I don't see that happening. You talked about one solution that I think is viable, and that is to produce hydrogen in places that aren't on the grid right now and transport that hydrogen using very low cost wind and solar. It's available now. We could do that now, especially as hydrogen technology improves. But also, once you have that hydrogen available and there's a market for it, I think you'll be able to offset a lot of the passenger EVs as well, not just the big trucks and buses. Furthermore, I think there's other solutions involving just distributed energy resources and leveraging endpoints without putting wire to the endpoint by taking off the need to bring wire by just building the energy production generation at that point at the end.
Yeah, agreed. And if I could say one more thing, one of the primary arguments against hydrogen comes down to efficiency. And it's the well-to-wheel efficiency when you talk about EVs and cars. With hydrogen, you can point out the 2/3 efficiency of an electrolyzer, the 50% efficiency of a fuel cell, and it starts to look like you're losing a lot of energy. One thing I would point out is that on the battery charging side, there's a lot of losses that aren't accounted for. It's not necessarily the 95% charge-recharge efficiency of the battery. There's other things that knock that down to something like 70%. But whatever, it's more efficient to do it directly with a battery. However, when you're talking about a primary energy source that has no cost, when you're talking about renewable energy, solar and wind, efficiency means you have to build more capital infrastructure. It's not that you're buying more of a particular oil or gas or something. It means you have to build bigger plants. And again, as we know that we have to build larger renewable resources, using hydrogen allows us to build in places that we couldn't have built before. So even if you could build more efficient or smaller solar arrays to feed grid-charged cars, you can't put them all the places that you need to. You will run out of real estate, or it will be more expensive because you have to use expensive real estate. So if you have to make that array a little bit bigger, but you can put it into a place that's less environmentally sensitive and you can do more of it, that is a huge benefit. And that really has to be taken into the calculus.
All arrows in the quiver.
All arrows in the quiver.
I'm going to wrap this up now, and I'm going to wrap it up with a wrap. Tim was concerned about the threat to evolution, so he stepped up his game on battling pollution. Bill Mollison's radio show discussed the impacts and risks. You heard about permaculture, and you gave up compact discs. He's lean. He's green. He likes hydrogen. The one and only Tim Sassine. Some might say hydrogen leaks and makes a hiss, but Tim gave up bottle rockets and kiss. Jeffrey Ballard's into fuel cells. He really cares. He's been leading Ballard Power for 40 years. You drink some champagne, but mostly bourbon, because it's very hard to launch a new wind turbine. It's true that startups often crash into the ground, so you have to be prepared to bounce around. You knew that finance and business education was the way, so you went to UCSD for your MBA. Your passion for hydrogen, hey, it made the sale. I believe it'll power airplanes, trucking, buses, ships, and rail, because it's a very low polluter. You're a big fan of the electric scooter. In talking to you, I certainly got the notion the most important thing to you is your son, Ocean.
Yeah, baby. I like it. Beautiful, beautiful.
I don't know what percentage of you follow the details of Tim's energy math, but it showed that the California requirement for electricity would approximately double once 100% transportation electrification is achieved. And the specific endpoint needs would likely be very different from today, requiring an extreme investment in utility infrastructure that is already fragile, combined with the cost of fire mitigation technologies, an already aging workforce, and distributed energy, which lowers the number of kilowatt hours the utility can load the infrastructure costs on, it should be a serious concern how high utility rates will rise. It is imperative that innovative energy solutions and business models be promoted, empowering new parties to enter the energy market, creating competition that drives down cost. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crivatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you're in San Diego and want to trade your concern about climate change for a few hours of some great laughs, most weeks I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates, and if you want to release from some of life's stress or to improve your speaking skills, consider taking an improv workshop at an improv club in your town. I very much appreciate Tim's passion for bringing his skills to bear on the climate change crisis. His technology vision of building hydrogen-specific solar and wind plants where it is uneconomical today due to the lack of proximity to the grid, and create high-density hydrogen as long-term storage can be an extremely valuable solution for solving the variable generation characteristics of renewable energy. And I very much appreciate his determination to explore new technologies and increase the depth and breadth of his skill set to help mitigate climate change.